he'll be fine. Okay, this is starting. All right, so my talk today is going to be on Dedekind spacetimes in the context of the quantum cosmology. And this is work that I've done with Abhay, and we're hoping to have this work out on the archive soon, and we're working on the preprint. All right, so in this talk, first I'll motivate it, although this has been very well motivated so far by the earlier talks today, and I'll set up some preliminaries that will be necessary to go on to the quantization. Then I'll look at the Hamiltonian constraint and what we do there, and we'll find that the Hamiltonian constraint is very messy, very complicated. And so we'll look at effective equations to try and get a handle as to what's going on. And we'll see what happens in two specific cases. And finally, I'll show how we can project the Hamiltonian constraint for the full Dedekind spacetime down to the Hamiltonian constraint for Eppardelli spacetimes, which was obtained in the APS papers. All right, so first of all, as Abhay pointed out, loop quantum cosmology so far has been very successful. The Big Bang singularity has been resolved, and there have been numerical simulations that show that there's a bounce when the energy density reaches Planck scales, and this has been done mostly in homogeneous isotropic cosmologies, but these results also persist when we have a cosmological constant, which Tamás will be talking about in the next talk, and also in closed universes. And so the next obvious step seems to be to try and incorporate anisotropies. And the Dedekind model is a relatively simple one, which does incorporate anisotropies, and so that's one reason to look at it. And I believe there will be a talk on Saturday that will go over how to incorporate inhomogeneities as well, but we'll ignore that for the time being. Also, the talks this morning about the BKL conjecture pointed out that if we want to look at cosmological singularities, the Dedekind spacetime is particularly interesting, as this one, as each particular point can be modeled by Dedekind spacetime with Dedekind transitions. And so if we want to understand what happens when quantum gravity effects are important, so for example, in your cosmological singularities, knowing how the Dedekind spacetime behaves is very interesting. And so that's another reason why we're interested in the loop quantization of Dedekind spacetimes. All right, so just before I get on with quantization, there are a few preliminaries I need to set up. And we're considering a homogeneous and non-compact space. So we'll have to restrict all of our integrations to a fiducial cell. Otherwise, it'll all diverge, and we won't be able to do anything. So we'll call that cell V. We'll make it cubical for simplicity. And we'll introduce triad and co-triad, which are adapted to this cell. Now, because of the symmetries of the Dedekind model, the triad and connection are very simple. They're entirely determined by these variables P and C here. And so, for example, E1 is determined by P1, and A1 is determined by C1 entirely. And if you take the standard form of the metric, which I wrote down here, and here N is the lapse, and A1, A2, and A3 are the directional scale factors, and obviously depend on time, we find that, for example, P1 is like P2, P3, and C1 is like A1, the time derivative of A1 divided by the lapse. So now we've got our spacetime set up, and we can go on to the quantization procedure and see just what happens. To do this, we want to consider the Hamiltonian constraint. And what we'll do is that we'll choose the matter field to be a massless scalar field for two reasons. Number one, it's simple. It makes our lives very easy. And also, it can act as a clock, as was discussed earlier. And this will make our comparison with classical spacetimes easier. And we also take the symmetries of the Dedekind spacetime into account, and that gives us the relatively simple form, which we find here, for the Hamiltonian constraint. And, of course, we can expand the E's in terms of P's and the field strength in terms of the C's, and we obtain this form here. And the last thing that we need to proceed to the quantization is the non-zero Poisson bracket, which we find here. And the only non-zero one is between Ci and Pj when I and J are the same. Okay. So to quantize the spacetime, we want to promote the variables to operators. This is easy to do for P, it just acts as multiplication on a state. So that's simple. We don't need to worry about that. But it's a lot more difficult for C because there is no operator corresponding to the connection in loop quantum gravity. Now, Abhay went over this in his talk, so I might be repeating a little bit, but hopefully it won't be too bad. Now, there do exist operators that correspond to holonomies. So what we can do is that we can get an operator for the field strength F by calculating the holonomy around a loop here and then dividing that by the area of the loop. And then we take the limit as the area of that loop goes to zero. Now, as has been pointed out, the area eigenvalues in loop quantum gravity are discrete. So we can't take this limit. It doesn't exist. So instead what we'll do is that we'll take the limit and instead set this area here to be the minimum eigenvalue in loop quantum cosmology, and we'll take the holonomy around that loop and calculate the field strength from that. But even this isn't enough, and to properly understand how exactly to do this, we'll have to consider the relationship between loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology. And basically, this is how we can think of the relationship between the two. We have our fiducial cell V here, and we have these flux lines that are going through it, which denote the gravitational field. Now, the area of a surface, let's say this one here, is determined by these flux lines that go through it. So if we want to take the holonomy around the smallest around a surface with the smallest area, we want a surface which is only traversed by one flux line. And we'll call this minimal non-zero area delta. Now, this picture is a little messy because I wanted to show exactly what's happening in the full three dimensions. So now I'll restrict the picture just to the 1-2 plane. So let's say this is the x1 axis and this is the x2 axis. And so what we want to do is that we want to calculate the field strength in the 1-2 direction by taking this holonomy around just one flux line in this plane. And of course, this goes all the way through, as was shown in Abhay's talk. And so what we do is that we go in the one direction, a direction of mu bar 1, then in the two direction, a direction mu bar 2, and then backwards in the one direction, backwards in the two direction, by the same lengths. And now the question is, what are these lengths here? And this is a quite difficult problem, which had us stumped for a little while. But we realized that the way to attack this is to divide this into plaquettes. And so a plaquette is one surface which is crossed by only one flux line. And its area is the minimum area delta. And also we know from the quantum setup that the physical area of this side is given by P3. So the physical area of P3, which is the physical area of all of this, is equal to the number of plaquettes times the area of each plaquette, which is delta. So we have this simple relationship here. And this is in terms of the physical metric. Now, before I go on to the next slide, I want to point out that these mu bars are in terms of the fiducial metric and not the physical metric, and this is important. So, according to the fiducial metric, the area enclosed by this holonomy here is given by mu bar 1, mu bar 2, the length of each side, times V0 to the 2/3. And that is given by the fiducial metric. And we also know that since there are N3 plaquettes, we can take the area of the entire side and divide that by number of plaquettes. And we find that mu bar 1 times mu bar 2 is equal to 1 over the number of plaquettes on that side. And using the relationship from the previous page, we find that that is just delta, the minimum area, divided by P3. Now, of course, this is for the 1-2 plane. And we can easily extend this to the other planes as well. And we get analogous results. And we find that mu bar 1, for example, is equal to the square root of P1 over P2, P3 times the square root of this minimum area. All right, so let me just briefly recap what I did. I'm trying to quantize the Hamiltonian constraint. It's easy to deal with the PIs because they just act by multiplication. It's much harder to quantize the field strength. So to attack that, we take the holonomy around the minimum area loop. And the question was how to do that. And so now all we need to do is to take the holonomy going in the direction mu bar 1 axis, calculate the holonomy, get the field strength from there, and we have our operator. And so we find that the Hamiltonian constraint for Bianchi 1, ignoring factor ordering ambiguities here, is given by this expression here. And I want to point out that inside the mu bars, there's a square root of delta. And if you take the naive limit of this minimum area going to 0, you retrieve the exact same equation that we had for the classical case. So that this delta is precisely the quantum effect which comes into play here. Now, unfortunately, the factor ordering choice isn't as straightforward as it was in APS, in the APS papers, because obviously PI doesn't commute with sine of mu bar I CI. But because the form of mu bar is so much more complicated, the sine terms themselves do not commute. So this is an issue which we need to address. And we just took the simplest way to deal with this was to symmetrize the constraint. And so we symmetrize the V factors. And here V is just, it can be thought of as the volume here. So we symmetrize that by having a square root of V, V, and square root. And obviously the same thing on this side. Then we have sine of I, sine J, sine I. So we symmetrize the constraint. And we'll take this form. And so we decided on the form of the constraint, the last thing we need to do is to figure out how exactly it acts on a state. So we'll expand the sine terms into complex exponentials, and that creates a problem of its own because the mu bar form is quite complicated, and these exponentials have this form. And that is quite complicated. We can simplify it a little bit by introducing these lambdas, which are just square roots of p's, and we get this form here. And then we can work through a little algebra, and we find that if we act with this complex exponential on a state, for example, mu bar 1 times c1, we find that all that we do is we shift the lambda 1 argument by an amount entirely determined by this v here. And this will provide a nice simplification. So what will happen is that, recall that we're acting twice. So we're going to be shifting two of these by different amounts, and this can get quite complicated. But V acts very nicely, and so what we'll do is that we'll drop lambda 3 and replace it by V, because this will simplify the form of the action of the Hamiltonian constraint. And so we collect all of these terms, we see how each one acts on a state psi, and we replace lambda 3 with V, and we get this result for the Hamiltonian constraint operator, which is obviously quite complicated. Now, here we have partial phi squared acting on the wave function. So this gives our time evolution. And I don't want to worry about this slide too much. There are just a few things I want to point out. First of all is that we can group, it's a difference equation, as it was in FRW, and we can group all the terms into four groups, into this group here, into this group here, this group here, this group here. Now, these two groups don't have their volume shifted. This group has its volume shifted by plus 4 here, and this group has its volume shifted by minus 4. So it's somewhat analogous to the FRW case, and we'll take advantage of that when we project our dynamics down to the FRW space-time. And also, the other thing I want to point out is that all the prefactors depend only on V. There is no dependence on direct dependence on lambda 1 or lambda 2 in the prefactors. So that's very nice as well. Now, obviously, this is a very complicated equation. And just by looking at it, we can't really tell just what is happening. And so actually, right now, Manuel and Frank are working on some numerical simulations to see exactly what happens. And we're looking forward to see what that shows and to see whether we get similar results as to what happens for the FRW case. But obviously, that'll be quite a challenge. Now, What we can do, however, and what has been done, is to consider the effect of equations. And this was done by Dawei and Kevin in an earlier paper. And first of all, why do we want to consider effective equations? Well, obviously, as we saw on the previous slide, the Hamiltonian constraint operator is extremely complicated. And so the effective equations can give us a feel as to what will happen there. Also, in FRW, the effective equations were an excellent approximation of the full dynamics, even at the bounds. Now, we don't necessarily expect them to hold at high densities or high curvatures, but they did in a simpler case, so there is some hope that maybe they will still hold for Bianchi 1. And since they are relatively easy to solve, and we can hope that they'll be as accurate as they were for FRW, they're worth looking into. Of course, we'll need to verify whether they are as accurate once we have the full numerical simulations and see whether the two correspond throughout. So these are some numerical runs that were done by Kevin. And we'll start off with Bianchi-1 spacetime, which is at least somewhat anisotropic. Somewhat isotropic. And so here we have the three components for the triads. And we find they're relatively close, and they're all decreasing. And it is hard to tell on this graph, but these three bounce at different times. Now, they're all pretty close to each other, but they do bounce at different times, and that's because the various vial shears reach the Planck regime at slightly different times, so the bounce happens at different times. We also find that the Ricci scalar is bounded. The energy density does not quite reach the critical energy density 0.41 on the board there. And also that the volume of the cell is bounded by below. So we avoid any zero volume states, which would be the singular states. Right. Yes. Yes. Yeah, the anisotropic energy density that you talked about in the first talk would probably bring this up a little bit. Well, would definitely bring it up a little bit. And in the more anisotropic case, it's even more marked here, because here we expect to have a lot more energy density than anisotropies. And so the matter energy density remains very small. But, of course, the anisotropy energy density is very large here. And we can tell that it's quite anisotropic because the triads are very spread out, and they're behaving differently as they hit in. And here it's a lot more obvious that there are several bounces because there are two peaks in the Ricci curvature. And again, the volume is bounded from below, so we avoid all zero volume states and avoid any singularity. Okay. So these are just two simple cases. Yes? Okay, so that is one of the triad components. No, this would be the triad, let's say P3. And I can't quite tell from here. Is it decreasing? Kevin, do you remember? Yeah, so it's decreasing very slowly, and then it bounces here, and then it increases very rapidly after the bounce. It's just a steep increase here. Yeah. These are just two examples, and there could be a lot more that could be done. But just to give you a basic picture of what the effective equations are indicating might happen when we have the full numerical simulations. All right. So the last thing that I want to cover in my talk is how to project these dynamics down to the FRW space times. And the idea is relatively simple. And all we want to do is we want to average over the anisotropies, which are basically the lambdas, while keeping the isotropic component, which is the volume, constant. And so all we do is that we introduce a new wave function, which we'll call chi, which only depends on v and phi. And all that is that we take our original wave function, psi, and sum over lambda 1 and lambda 2. So we're trying to remove the anisotropies by summing over them. And what we do is that we sum over lambda 1, lambda 2 in the Bianchi-1 Hamiltonian operator, and we find this equation here. And this is exactly the quantum Hamiltonian constraint operator for FRW spacetimes, which was found in the APS papers. There are some slight differences about the prefactors, and that is just because there were different factor ordering choices that we chose and that were chosen in the APS papers. But if we take that into account, you get the exact same result. And this leads us to an interesting point, because you can't embed an FRW state in the Bianchi 1 Hilbert space. So if you were to create, let's say, at a certain time, an FRW state, you create a wave function which only has support where all the lambdas are equal. So you could do that at one time, but then you try to evolve that, and you'd find that your new wave function, which has been evolved one time step, now has support on points where the lambdas are not all equal. So that state is no longer isotropic. So it's impossible to embed an FRW state in the Bianchi 1 Hilbert space. However, as I just showed, we can average over degrees of freedom to obtain the FRW dynamics. So it seems, quote-unquote, more natural to average over these degrees of freedom to obtain a more symmetric state rather than trying to embed the symmetric state in the larger Hilbert space. All right. So in conclusion, we identified a heuristic relation between loop quantum gravity and loop quantum cosmology, and we used this to determine our choice of u-bar. We have a well-defined Hamiltonian constraint operator for Bianchi 1 spacetimes. It's quite complicated, but it is well-defined. And there exist effective equations which describe the quantum corrected dynamics of the system, and they show that there's a bounce, or several bounces. And I also showed how we can average over the anisotropies of the Bianchi 1 model to obtain the Hamiltonian constraint operator for FRW spacetimes. Thank you. I believe most of the previous ones had a mu bar I, which was delta over pi, I think. And because before we had the relationship between LQG and LQC, it wasn't quite clear what to do, because in FRW, you simply have mu bar is equal to delta over p, and only one p, so that was solved. And then, well, how do you generalize this to Bianchi 1? And so the most obvious answer seemed to be this one, but then you have problems because your dynamics depend on your cell. So my choice is mu bar I is PI over BJBK. What, sorry?
After factor ordering choices in the constraint, this particular value of U bar has to be. And it's still enough for that it's only just done by PI. I think it's very important.
I don't know.
I don't think that the operator corresponds to the sign of mu bar I CI to this mu bar I. That is where everything was stuck for the longest time. What is an operator? And the general philosophy was that that operator is hard perspective, don't know what perspective. And anyway, there was a view. This is what was the hardest point. And that's, I think, one of the solved analysis. How do you write down the operator? Sign of u bar 1 c 1. That was never constructed through the brain. With this definition of u bar, as opposed to. If you take the bottom definition of u bar, then it is relatively straightforward. On the left hand side,
this one.
The second point was that even if after revised how to restrict this operator, his expression was, I had that expression, but I did not dare to send it to manual, and manual One of the beautiful things that is happening here is that I'm really, really grateful that professional numerical analysts are getting interested in this area. Because the computations involved are really outside the whole object of the people that are working in the group on this one. But I did not dare to send this to manuals because things were so horrible and so complicated that I did not want anyone to kind of spend time on that. And then the last thing was total proof, the realization that in fact, instead of using lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, you just, I also tried the Disney variables. It doesn't simplify the quantum constraint at all. Tried all kinds of things. But if instead of using lambda 1, lambda 2, and lambda 3, you use lambda 1, lambda 2, and the volume for some reason, then even then the constraint is reasonably complicated, so it's something that can be put up. And that's it. So there are 2 points which I have not realized in the literature. And the final thing is that this use of V was critical in finding this projection. I just, for me, conceptually, this was a big surprise. That, I mean, long time ago, Ryan had pointed out that there's a problem. If you have mini superspace and a smaller mini superspace, the dynamics that you get in smaller mini superspace does not agree with the dynamics that you get in the larger mini superspace. Problem is what Egg just mentioned, namely, even if you started out with the space, with the state of the smaller mini superspace, and evolved it using the dynamics of the larger mini superspace, the state does not remain in the smaller mini superspace. So it looked like we would never be able to make contact, like in the Yankee models and the Friedman model, but we want a contact. And the idea that you can just average on the anisotropies and get exactly, not approximately, but exactly the same constraint was surprising. That was possible because of the use of lambda was lambda 2 as opposed to.
So just one more
remark, a brief comment. Yeah, because exactly this lambda 1, lambda 2 is easily answered, but also for the other questions, could not be defined as nothing constructive, but different equations. Just because these numerical things are starting, there are finite systems, they have looked at these different equations. So therefore, in some ways, they have constructed with patterns and things. So it is possible. They usually just these two variables, the simple equation, and the simple equation, which is probably useful as a
we're going to have this discussion during the
discussion.
Okay. So let's